Well, here we are again, another nice winter day. The message that I gave last time, which was December 23rd, it had a very high number of visits on YouTube, and I was kind of surprised. But from that, I gathered that there's a lot of interest in what I was talking about at that time, which was the difference between Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 2. That message focused on, and it reviewed the details concerning the formation of the 10 toes of the beast power. Now, we're familiar with the image in Daniel chapter 2, which leads down to the 10 toes that is going to be struck by a rock from above that destroys the image that we read there. And pretty much every religion understands the symbolism in that particular image. It's the other one that's the problem. Daniel 2 is a series of successive world empires. But Daniel 7 presents a different picture. It focuses in on the very end phase of what we read in Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 7 presents the formation of the seventh restoration of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, I emailed out to most people that I expected would be online today a list of what those seven restorations were. I found something online that was very good, so I thought I would at least put that out there by way of taking needing to take less time to present that particular phase. But what we're talking about in Daniel chapter 7 is the formation of those 10 toes as the world empire, the seventh restoration of the Holy Roman Empire, which we realize existed in and was formed in Central Europe, not Rome itself. Not Rome in Italy, but the empires that came to be in Central Europe, four of which were German, of all things. Those were Justinian, Charlemagne, Otto the Great, the Habsburg Empire, the Habsburgs, Napoleon, and then the Hitler-Mussolini axis. Those are six. There's one more to go. Now, we have an extraordinary prophecy, and we find it in Daniel chapter 11. And that's what I want to cover today, because Daniel 11 gives us more perspective on that particular empire. And it's unusual in its extreme accuracy. Daniel 11 is so accurate of a series of events that occurred in world history that Bible students, denominations, eschatologists are bewildered with it, because how can any prophecy be so accurate? It goes through a series of struggles between two major world powers at the time, and those two were the Seleucids and the Ptolemies of Egypt. They struggled back and forth between one another for world supremacy for centuries. And when people read this account of it in Daniel 11, they're forced to conclude that it had to have been written after the fact, because it is so precise. Now, there are many sources that you can go and look to that will give you the explanation of what each of these phases represent. But there's something about this chapter that it should be particularly interesting to us, because it was not written after the fact. It was not written as history, but it was prophecy from Daniel's day. Daniel lived long before the time of Alexander the Great. He lived long before his empire was divided up between his four generals and two in particular. So it had to be written beforehand. The thing is, Jesus Christ himself instructed us to look to this chapter. In Matthew 24:15, he makes reference to this, and we should read that just to give ourselves some perspective here. Matthew 24:15, where he says, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee unto the mountains." Jesus Christ himself is telling us that that particular passage of Scripture has a latter day fulfillment. It was history as it happened. It was prophesied before it happened. But all of this that we read in Daniel 11 is now on the historical record as having happened for almost two centuries before the time that Jesus Christ said what he said. He said something. We see something similar in Matthew 13:14, where it repeats basically that same statement. But Jesus Christ himself spoke to the legitimacy of what Daniel presented in his chapter 11. But there's internal evidence as well. And that evidence is found there in verse 29, for example, where it says, this is Daniel 11:29, "At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter." Now think about what that's telling us. He's saying there's going to be a repetition, but that repetition is not going to be like it was fulfilled the first time. Different time frame, different geographical regions involved, and different players. This is no longer the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. These are different. There is a king of the north, and there is to be a king of the south. And these two great powers are going to clash rather violently in the last days. And that king of the north is the entity that we know of as the ten toes of Daniel chapter 2, which is also the ten kings of other prophecies that will coalesce themselves together to form what we know as the beast power. There are ten kings that are going to coalesce, they're going to unite themselves, and they're going to create a power block that is going to be the key political and military force that's going to dominate the world at the end time. So those references attest to the dual application of this particular prophecy. But the thing to understand is, it isn't the entire chapter that's dual. It is that latter half of the chapter. Now, I speculate myself that it's probably about verse 29 where the dual overlay begins. And you can see it somewhat hinted at in the wording, "At the time appointed, he shall return." Now, keep in mind, the final figure in the first historic fulfillment was a dude we call Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, his career was over 190 years before the time of Christ. So it can't be referring to him. It's got to be referring to another great, powerful individual. So at the time appointed, he shall return and shall come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. The latter fulfillment is going to be different than it was the first time around. While there are certain characteristics, perhaps, that are similar, keep in mind it's different players this time. But I think it's about verse 29 where the second application, the dual application, begins. Now, I want to take and read through this quickly, and then we'll back over it and point out some of the things that this particular prophecy tells us. So starting in verse 29, it reads, and I'm going to go read straight through it without comment, and then we'll come back. But it says, at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. And arms shall stand on his part. And they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. This is the passage, this is the area that Jesus Christ is referring to, and he wants us to be alert to watch for this, because it's a key component. Verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them, to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. There's that key again. And the king shall do according to his will. Now, this is talking about the king of the north. He shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. Think about that. And at the time of the end, so we know where we are here. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall else enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, being Jordan He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So we know the region where this king of the south is going to be. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all of the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. As we draw to the end, it says, but tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to take away many. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. It's not a very long passage, but is certainly profound in what it says. But let's go back through this and point out some interesting things, because the amount of detail that is included in this is astounding. And we should know this information. We should have this picture in our minds of what is going to happen on Christ's own instructions. He says, be alert, watch for this, because it's going to happen. This is under his control. That's how he knows for sure what is going to be. But let's go through it more analytically now. And I'll pause and comment on each of the phrases, because so many of them are potent beyond belief. But we started with verse 29, where it says, at the time appointed. So from that we know that there is a timetable when these events are going to be initiated. He shall return. What does that mean? This power structure is going to reform. It hasn't done much of anything yet, but it's going to orient his thinking towards the south. What's there? Well, as we read later, we realize that there is a power block also to his south. And what's their significance? Well, that power block to the south has control over the world's energy sources. And as time gets developed further along, those energy sources are going to be all the more critical. EVs aren't going to do it, pal. They're not. You're going to need oil. A lot of it. Because of everything that depends on it. Transportation particularly. And military forces particularly. One of the things that caused Hitler all the problems is they didn't have enough oil that they needed. Okay? So we can see the importance. But we know from verse 29 that the end time repeat of this prophecy is going to be a little different than it was historically. We understand that. Verse 30, interesting. It talks about the ships of Kittim coming against him. What is that? Anciently, the ships of Kittim were a naval power, a naval presence in the eastern Mediterranean that factored into these political interplays between the two kings that had a say in what happens and what doesn't. Now, in the modern era, there is a naval presence in the Mediterranean. We know who that is. And they're going to say to the king of the north, nothing doing. And he's not going to be happy about that. In verse 30 it says, therefore he shall be grieved. Not going to be a happy camper. Because this naval presence is going to stand in his way to prevent him from what he wants to do. So what does he do about it? Well, he gets Rip House mad. It says he will have indignation. Oh, you betcha. Against, notice, and here's a big question, against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. What is that? It appears that these people who are the holy covenant are the ones that can affect that naval presence. That's who he goes to solve his little problem of somebody standing in his way. Now, he's going to marshal together a military force as well, verse 31. And arms shall stand on his part. He's going to have a military, but not one that he dares throw against this naval presence until it's removed out of the way. And they, who's they? The holy covenant seekers, breakers? And they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. What is the sanctuary of strength? Could it be the military establishment of the day? They're going to corrupt the military, reduce its effectiveness somehow. And besides that, they're going to take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. Now, that passage is getting a little ahead of the story because that comes a little later in time. But the point is, he's giving us an overview of what this coalition of powers, this king of the north, the beast power, as we know it, is going to do. Another little technique, and we see that in the political world of our day, verse 32. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. He's going to use his influence, and we can be sure that there's some cash involved here. Yep. They that do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. And now here's a break in the picture. Here's a break in the story flow. And this one is particularly relevant to God's people. He breaks off by saying, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. This is what God's people are going to be doing at the time. Yet they shall fall by the sword, and by flame, by captivity and spoil, many days. How long is the many days? We'll come to that. Now, when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help. Some encouragement there. We got some tough times to face. And here's another component in this situation. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. They're going to be so enamored with our wonderfulness when they're not themselves genuine. Continues in verse 35. This is a major segment that's talking about God's people in amongst all of this. Verse 35, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them. This is why this is happening. To try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end. So we're locked into when this is going to be, because it is yet for a time appointed. That's where we started this narrative in verse 29. There is a particular segment of time that this is to be, is to occur in. And then it breaks back to the king of the north. And the king shall do according to his will. This is verse 36. And he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. Can we imagine a political figure doing such a thing? Has that ever been done before? A Messiah type in political power? Think of some recent history there. The king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, the true God, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. God's telling us he's in charge of all this. He's telling us about it. He wants us to know what's going to be happening. Verse 37, still talking about this beast power. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. It's going to break from traditional religion. He might have been religious himself to start with, but he's going to see things differently. He's going to place himself differently. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver. There's the key. He's going to have the treasure of the world. And with precious stones and pleasant things, all kinds of luxuries. What do you do with those? You bribe people. You use them for power. And when you've got them, when you've given them some of these things, you've got them. You've got them. They're in your control. This is what he's going to do. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. He's going to sell the rights to rule certain regions to the highest bidder. Now that tells you how much power this individual is going to have at that point in time. He's going to have control over a wide swath of geography. There's going to be a part of the world that he doesn't have control over, and we'll read about them shortly. But he's going to sell regional control to the highest bidder. And you can be sure there's going to be a lot of those. And think of what that's going to do to his wealth. And that's going to cause a provocation. We read of that in verse 40. And at the time of the end, so we're still tied into this time frame. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south. Now we got a new power emerging from the scene here. The king of the south shall push at him. And it's going to cause a major backlash reaction. The king of the north isn't going to put up with it. He's got reasons to want to control that region of the world. And the reason being, that's where the oil is, for the most part. That's where the power is. You don't have oil, you don't do much of anything. So the king of the north shall come against him, still in verse 40, like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Now, what nations on earth have many ships? It's not something the Middle East is known for. Kind of tells us who the players are going to be here. And these many ships are assigned to the king of the north. Verse 41, he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. And it tells us which ones are accepted for whatever reason, whether they voluntarily join the alliance, who knows. He shall stretch forth his hand, verse 42, also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. So it sort of gives us a geographical area as to where this region of influence is going to encompass. But the fun part starts where we get down to about verse 44. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. You see, there's another power block in the world that has still been out of the scene here in the interplay into the struggles between the king of the north and the king of the south. There is still a third world power, and it tells us where they come from. East and north of the Middle East. He's going to hear about it. They're going to be marshaling. They're going to be preparing an invasion. And he's going to be concerned. He's got good reason to be concerned. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Now from other prophecies we know where that force is going to come from. There is that 200 million man army that is beyond the Euphrates. More clues, more information. But it tells us what he's going to have done up to this point in time. He is going to plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, Jerusalem area. He's going to place his military headquarters there in Jerusalem area. And despite that, it says, he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Now, how's that going to happen? We got this great invading force coming from a direction that we would call from the northeast. And another prophecy says God is going to assemble these forces in a place called Armageddon. They're going to be marshaling, they're going to be gathering to do battle with one another. Yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. How's that going to happen? Well, we have other prophecies that tell us it's not going to be a clash between these two forces. It isn't that one is going to be victorious over the other. Not the point at all. And that's the twist here in this amazing story. This is the point in time. And those of us who understand, those of us who are wise in these matters, will realize this is the point in time when Jesus Christ is going to come and put an end to all of this nonsense. Now, there's another little issue here, and it's sort of alluded to in that part of the passage that talks about what is going to be happening with the elect. But all during this period of time, or through at least the central part of it, is going to be the career, the 3.5-year career of the two witnesses. Now think about it. When they're doing their thing, what is the rest of the church going to be doing? They're going to be saying what they say. They're going to be doing what they do. They're going to be confronting the world condition as it exists in their time. But what is the church going to be doing? I would say, based on their ministry, that we are going to be behind the scenes explaining and expanding upon what they're saying. Those are the exploits that God's people are going to be doing. It's going to be the basis for it. Think about that. Let's reflect back to Daniel 9:26 for a moment, because this brings us into that time frame also, and it tells us something more about what's going to be happening. Verse 26, and after 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And this is referring to the 70 weeks prophecy. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood and unto the end of the war. Desolations are determined. So this is an allusion to what we've read in Daniel chapter 11, two chapters later. Verse 27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation. And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Kind of convoluted language, and it's hard to get a clear picture of what this is talking about. But there's going to be an interruption of the religious practices that are going on in Jerusalem at that time. It's kind of overwhelming. This is a massive amount of information. But God has given us something essential. In another place in Daniel, it talks about the wise will understand, but none of the wicked will understand. So people can be looking at what's going on and have no clue as to what it really means. But the people that know God will understand. He's given us huge swaths of information. We've seen the formation of the beast power in one chapter. We're seeing his career and what he's going to be doing, his campaign against humanity, in this chapter, Daniel 11. But let's review some of the things that we've just talked about. I've got 35 points here of things that we've learned from this particular chapter. Number one, a religious leader will encourage and facilitate the formation of the Ten King Alliance. There's going to be a religious leader that is going to be the instigator. Now, there's other factors. I realize there's a military threat. There is certain things going on besides that where it's going to be advisable for these ten nations to get together for survival, because the world situation is going to be very, very different. And that can be happening very quickly. There's stuff going on right now that bear watching. Of course, you won't hear it on your news, but number two, we expect this to be a great world church, one that has been in existence for centuries and one that has a close connection with these ten kings. These ten will be affiliated with that religious institution, and their kings have been coronated by this religious power for centuries. Do we need to paint a picture here? The ten kings will coalesce into a great political combine, that being the seventh head of the Holy Roman Empire. Not Rome itself, this is the restorations of the Roman system that came to be after Rome fell in Central Europe. We know that the two entities, the religious entity and the political entity, the two will mutually promote and support one another. And verse 29 of Daniel 11 tells us that there is a specific point in time assigned by God to this development. And we know also from the same verse that it's not to be a repeat of the former fulfillment. This time, different players, different regions. And then another southern coalition will provoke the king of the north, the beast power. And the beast power will intend to and will ultimately occupy the Middle East. But first, there will be an obstructing naval presence in the Mediterranean that has to be gotten rid of. That naval presence will need to be negated by back-channel intrigue first. There will be negotiations with a people identified as those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And that's a marvelous mystery. Who are they? That diplomacy and extortion to remove the obstruction to their intentions to invade is to be accomplished by that means. So there's a connection between these covenant forsakers and that naval power. If you want to get rid of the naval power, you go to those who forsake the covenant. There's obviously a connection there. Kind of gives us a little bit to go on by way of identifying both. And once that's accomplished, the king of the north will be free to invade overwhelmingly and quickly. The king of the south will be no match for what's going to come upon them. Now, this king of the north will have control over the world's economy, its resources, and its treasures. He's going to sell regional influence to the highest bidder. Buying and selling will be monitored and restricted among people who are non-compliant. We know that from another prophecy. There'll be a marker of some sort to identify who's compliant and who is not. We know about that in the prophecies that talk about the mark of the beast. The non-compliant will be excluded from commerce. There's a passage that tells us those that don't have the mark of the beast are not going to be able to buy or sell. If that's not economic control, what is? But in amongst all this, there's going to be a pointed crusade against the elect. The saints will be persecuted and exposed to extreme trials. We know about the passages that talk about an end-time martyrdom of saints. It's going to happen. Count on it. The saints will know what's going on. It's hard to say what anyone else will know, but the saints will know. Now, this king of the north is going to embrace and promote a strange, we could say man-made, religious system, not one involving God at all. They no allusion to proclaiming or supporting or presenting the real, true God of the world, the universe. Now, there's another little caveat in the middle of all of this, and we can read of it in Revelation chapter 18. And there's a mention of it in Revelation 17, verse 16. And this is a little detail that is sort of inserted from outside, but it's something we need to be aware of, because it sort of gives us a clue as to the identity of the religious power that is going to mutually foment and support the beast power. 17:16 and 17. And the ten horns which you saw. Now, we've described who those ten horns are, the ten horns of the ten kings, which represent the ten toes of the image in Daniel chapter 2. But the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Now think about that. These are the ten kings who had a religious preference throughout history. They're going to get fed up with the interference of that religious institution, and they're going to turn against it and obliterate it. And you can read of that in Revelation chapter 18, which basically describes that. Verse 17 says, "For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. Let's throw in verse 18. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Is that clear? Should be. We know who these players are. Something else we know from Daniel 11 is that this beast power will establish his military headquarters in the Jerusalem area. We read that. And he will also encompass a huge military alliance. All of those areas that he sold regional control of to the highest bidder will themselves have militaries. And he's going to call in those militaries to defend himself at Armageddon against what he suspects is coming. So he's going to call in all his favors out there. So we can see where basically all the armies of the earth are going to be involved in this conflagration. Picture that. And somewhere during these 3.5 years, he's going to bring to an end the sacrificial system that had been recently reinstated. We know that from some other prophecies. And then we have the development of a far eastern power block that is going to mobilize and move toward the Middle East and cross the Euphrates River. He's going to create an opposing force to assemble, to engage this invading force from the northeast. God is going to bring all nations to Armageddon. He says that in another prophecy. But Daniel 11 concludes with the fact that his regime is going to end right then and there. There's going to be no power that can rescue what's happening. And we understand who the major combatant is, being Jesus Christ and his army. We can understand there won't be anything to help him. And all of this brings us up to the point, for the moment in time, with the event that we know as the Second Coming. Now, there's an interesting little detail that we read in the concluding verses of chapter 11, where we saw earlier that the religious institution had been destroyed, basically at God's instruction. But the false prophet is still going to be alive. So that tells us the false prophet is not necessarily the head of that religious institution that we might suspect. There is another religious power above him. Think about that. Because the beast and the false prophet are going to survive Armageddon, be captured and cast alive into the lake of fire. So those are the things that we know. Just there's maybe more, but these are the details that jump out to me that we find in Daniel chapter 11. It gives us an overview of a great series of military, political, religious, and financial events that are going to take place in the world just ahead of us. Jesus Christ, in his concern for his saints, has told us in advance what to expect, what to be looking for. We can appreciate his expression towards us, his concern for his saints, that we know what's going on, so that we're better prepared to deal with what happens to us. Because we also are going to be a focus of this great world power. So hopefully now you know all about Daniel chapter 11.